Hello, and thank you for joining us for Research in Progress at Shawnee State University, brought to you by the Teaching and Learning Center, located in Clark Memorial Library in beautiful Southern Ohio. On this podcast, we celebrate faculty achievement and highlight their current projects. We want to know what fuels their passion for research and education. What do higher education professionals spend their lives learning about? Find out in today's episode. Welcome, everyone, to Research in Progress. I'm Dr. Jen Scott, and my guest today is Dr. Monica Orlando, who's an assistant professor in my home department of English and Humanities. She's completed extensive research in literature for young people, including the depiction of disability in children's books. She received her PhD in English from Case Western Reserve University in 2015, and her MA and bachelor's degrees from John Carroll University. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Orlando.
Thank you.
So tell us about your position here at Shawnee. What courses do you teach, and what do you do outside of your teaching?
I teach composition courses, so 1101, 1105, Intro to Literature, the Young Adult Literature course, which is mostly for middle school and high school English teacher candidates, as well as methods of teaching language arts for that same population. And I also supervise those student teachers when they go out into the field for their methods field experience and their student teaching. So I get to work with the teacher education department, even though I'm in English and humanities. I also direct the Writing Center, so that's fun and exciting. And I serve on a variety of committees, maybe not so fun and exciting. And I write and present papers at conferences. I try to do at least one a year, usually related to disability and literature for young people. I've also published several articles in the past couple of years about disability and young adult literature or disability and autobiographical writing.
All right, wonderful. Dr. Orlando, in a nutshell, what would you say it is that you study?
I study representations of disability in literature. So that's taken a couple of different forms. In my dissertation, this was primarily focused on autobiographical writing by people with autism or family members with autism. So I talked about memoirs by people in various positions on the autism spectrum, parent memoirs by people whose children have autism, as well as collaborative memoirs between people with and without autism. I was interested in how these works of life writing represented life with autism, so how people were describing their own experience, especially from the inside, but also how they drew upon and represented relationships between them and other people, especially people with and without disabilities. I found this particularly interesting in regard to autism because social interactions are one of the things that people with autism are supposed to be lacking, either something that they can't really engage in or that they don't care about. So relationships actually show up quite often in these narratives, but they often look different from how people would expect. So I was kind of looking at relationships between people with and without disabilities. So I'm continuing to study disability, but it's kind of taken different tracks since my dissertation. So I was initially focused mostly on autobiographical writing, but I've since become very interested in young adult literature. So I've been exploring young adult literature that deals with disability in some way. I'm still particularly interested in developmental disabilities, so things like autism or Down syndrome that are often a little bit more invisible or hidden than some more obvious physical disabilities. People often think of disability as someone in a wheelchair, which is obviously one form of disability, but there are so many others. And I think for able-bodied people, sometimes it's hard to conceptualize what disability means for people who have other sorts of disabilities that you might not be able to see. So, you know, we might think, okay, people with a wheelchair need a ramp to get in a building, but what do people with all different kinds of disabilities need in order to be successful in the world and, you know, to integrate with others and that sort of thing? So I'm mostly interested in looking at that kind of disability, just because I think that's an unexplored, less explored area. And disabilities are becoming more of a presence in recent years in literature for young people. There are more books that have characters with disabilities. So I'm interested in seeing what it looks like, how it's received, what it means for people with and without disabilities when these things are in literature.
Yeah, and there's a field of disability studies that your work is situated within, and that's a field that I kind of became aware of through my own dissertation research, but it's one that I think maybe doesn't have the public attention in the same way that some other disciplines do. Could you maybe tell us a little bit, for our listeners who aren't familiar with disability studies, for whom that's a new term, how would you describe that area of scholarship?
Disability studies is the study of disability, just like it sounds, in texts, in culture, and in society. So there are a multitude of things that people who do disability studies can study. I think it calls attention to disability as a reality and as an identity, and asks people to think about it critically, what disability is, what it means, how we interpret it, how we represent it, and how that affects real people. I'm obviously most interested in looking at disability in literature, but I think there are lots of different types of texts you can look at that represent disability in some way. And I've explored some other types of texts. I've looked at television and movies a little bit as well. But also as a teacher and educator of teachers, I'm interested in disability in education, which I think is another sort of branch of disability studies. So I try to call attention to real people, especially students with disabilities, when I'm working with middle school and high school students. So I'm interested in the presence of disability in the classroom, and the interaction between what we read, what we teach, and the people that we teach. So I think that's another area to focus on, not only how is disability represented in text, but what does it mean in the real world, and the ways that we kind of treat it. I think disability is still an understudied area of identity. I think there's more and more attention to gender, race, ethnicity, sexual diversity, and those are all really good things. Disability deserves attention as well, and I think it's still an afterthought in a lot of situations. So I think disability studies has become a bigger and bigger thing since it's kind of originated in the early 1990s, but I think there's still room for growth there as far as where we look for what disability is and does and how we think about it.
Yeah, especially how disability can intersect with other sites of identity, mm-hmm. like race and gender and class. There is a lot of really fascinating, important work that's been done, but it's a body of scholarship that there are still, I mean, like all bodies of scholarship, we're always adding and always incorporating new understandings of things.
Yeah, and certainly there's disability is not separate from all of those other things. And,
No. What was it that initially drew you to this research? What got you interested in disability and literature?
It's a good question. People always ask, do you have somebody with disability in your family? Do you have somebody with autism, especially because I focused on that for so long? And I don't directly, and I always push back against that a little bit, the idea that the only reason you might be drawn to this is because of a personal connection. But I think a lot of people do come to disability studies because of that. So it's not a bad reason, but not the only reason. I kind of came into it by chance. I started out, actually, my sister recommended to me the movie about Temple Grandin. That came out around the time when I was in grad school. Claire Danes stars as Temple Grandin. and it was kind of my first foray into, I think, thinking more about autism and especially about someone telling their own story. So I read Temple Grandin's book that the movie is based on called Thinking in Pictures. And then from there started looking at more autobiography about autism. And at that time, it was sort of a boom for autistic autobiography. There were tons of texts and they continued to come out, but it was sort of, hers was the first very well-known autistic autobiography. So I was like, this is neat. I kind of like this and I wanted to dig deeper into it. So it wasn't, I didn't really go searching for it. It just sort of found me. And it seemed like something that I wanted to learn more about, that I wanted to get into further. And I was interested in life writing. I was kind of thinking about different ways to get into that, like how people narrate their lives. And because this was something sort of new and that hadn't been explored a whole lot, it seemed like an interesting place to kind of dive in.
Yeah. It's whenever I talk to people about their research and how they got there, it seems like we always end up in an area that's a little bit different than where we thought we were going to end up. Like I ended up doing some exploration disability studies too, but I started by looking at the controversy about vaccines and autism and vaccine refusal. And I ended up kind of stumbling into disability studies because people were writing about their autistic kids in ways that were deeply troubling. And I was like, surely someone has written about this already. I am not noticing something new. And I wasn't, of course, but it was an area of scholarship that I was not fully aware of, unfortunately. But
yeah, and that's interesting. I didn't look too much at parents writing about their children in negative ways.
Yeah.
There is a ton of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of it online as well. That's a whole different. I only sort of touched on online writings about people's lives, but that's often troubling to me. But I looked at some examples of what I thought were positive. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm always kind of geared toward like, here, what's being done well in this field?
Yeah.
So there are some interesting examples. Clara Claiborne Park was one of the earliest parents to write mm-hmm. about her daughter with autism in what I think are mostly positive ways. You know, she acknowledges, and I think there's always a balance to be struck between acknowledging the difficult parts of disability as well as going beyond that, that it's not all a problem, right? It's not
right.
It's not all difficult, and people with disabilities are not problems to be mm-hmm. solved. But you know, there are ways that disability can be made easier, and you know, so I think it's often a difficult thing for people to write about from their own perspective, and also for us to think about as a society,
yeah,
how to balance that, like the difference of disability with it can have good things about it too, and it's it's life.
Yeah, it's just life. I mean, you wrote about that in your presentation for Festival of Faculty Achievement. In that paper, in that presentation, you looked at representations of disability in books for younger children. And one of the books that you wrote about, I'm going to forget the title, but it was written from the perspective of an autistic child. And the message was like, it's okay to be neurotypical. Mm-hmm. It's okay if you don't flap your hands when you're excited. So it kind of flipped the script mm-hmm. in a way.
Why Johnny Doesn't Flap.
Yes. Yes, that's what it was.
And I was excited to find that book. I mean, it was kind of, as I was working on that paper, I was looking at some different examples, and a lot of them were sort of predictable. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not a bad message to tell neurotypical kids it's okay to be friends with kids who are autistic or kids who have other disabilities. And that's usually how the book kind of goes, to show them there are people who are different from you. It's okay to be different. And here's some of the ways that you can kind of handle that. But yeah, I really liked that book because it acknowledges that other children also read books who may not be able-bodied or typical. So the fact that it's really aimed at an autistic reader, and even the parents' note at the back is aimed at parents with autistic children, and you know, kind of says your child will come in contact with neurotypical kids as many as 1 in 68 or as many as 67 in 68 are neurotypical. It talks about disability in a way that I think we're not used to, and I think that's really refreshing. It's good to have disability represented more than it used to be, mm-hmm. But it's still, I think, often from a particular perspective rather than acknowledging that there are lots of people who are reading books and consuming things in the world who also have disabilities.
Yeah, as someone who studies rhetoric, I'm always kind of coming back to the question of audience. And if all of the books are written with an assumption that the audience is non-disabled, but we're writing about disability, well, like you said, about 20% of the population is disabled or will be at some point in their lives. Part of your audience may be disabled, and if they're only looking at it from an outsider's perspective all the time, if those are the only representations that are available, then we're missing something. Like we're not addressing the issue the way we probably should.
Mm. And I think a lot of disability scholars say everyone is going to be disabled at some point in their lives, in some way, especially if you live to be elderly, at some point it's going to happen.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So it's not something that's outside the bounds of regular experience. And I think that's one of the things that I was trying to get at with my study of children's books is mm-hmm. looking for children's books that represent it as part of everyday experience rather than something that's odd and rare and doesn't really need to be talked about.
Yeah, and we often think of disability as a permanent state, but we mm-hmm. all experience temporary disability, even if you are not, you know, if you're an able-bodied person, scare quotes mm-hmm. around that, if you've ever broken an arm or had to use crutches, like any of that, it temporarily disables you and you realize like, oh, my house is not accessible. Bummer. I really hope I don't have to use a walker or a wheelchair at some point in a more permanent way.
Yeah, and I think it's those kinds of experiences that often draw people's attention mm-hmm. to the fact that, oh, this place might not be accessible. I never noticed that before. Or this experience is a little bit more difficult because of X, Y, or Z when mm-hmm. I can't do this, and start, you know, recognizing that the world can be a really difficult place for people who aren't able-bodied or typical, that we don't notice if we don't have some sort of disability, temporary or not.
Yeah, like I just read something about how the modern American home is designed for someone who is 5'7", mm-hmm. and that's why I can't use 2/3 of my cabinets because I'm 5'2".
And that's an interesting, I mean, there's been a movement lately to design houses that people can stay in their whole lives,
yeah,
which,
yeah.
you know, is sometimes just aimed at like the retirement community, mm-hmm. but, you know, wider doorways. So in case people need to use wheelchairs, they'll be able to fit and lower cabinets and lower countertops and, you know, maybe in the future, houses will be designed that way that at least keeps in mind. Not yeah. everybody is the same size and ability, but yeah, it's going to take a while.
I mean, if you think about the duration of a mortgage, I'm going to be in my 60s when I finally own that house. So I'm going to be in a position potentially in my later life where I can't use all of my house or might have trouble getting in and out of my home. And so, you know, are there things I can do to prepare my house? Probably, but it would be nice if the home had been designed that way to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think it would be that hard to do that. Why don't we do that? If you had to speculate, why don't we design the world in a way that's more accessible?
I'm thinking of the house that I lived in Cleveland that was built in 1922 uh-huh. that was absolutely inaccessible to any sort of, very narrow doorways, stairs, you know, both in and out of the house. And I think historically we didn't have a whole lot of consideration for mm-hmm. disability, in part because, I mean, there weren't as many ways for people, I don't even know when modern wheelchairs kind of, that people could move themselves came yeah. into being. And 1922 wheelchairs strike me as being the kind that someone needed to push you and had like those little
yeah.
wheels, you know,
yeah,
so
probably.
So I, you know, I think the more that we've kind of accommodated people with disabilities moving into everyday life, mm-hmm. The more we've recognized those needs. But I think it's just a slow process.
Yeah.
And, you know, building design and whatnot yeah. needs to catch up.
And I suppose more people with certain disabilities survive to adulthood mm-hmm. to a greater degree than they did 100 years ago or 50, even 50 years ago. So there might be part of it as well.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing to think about, too, from the perspective of memoir. I mean, some of the early memoirs were about children with disabilities mm-hmm. dying very young because they didn't yeah. have medical care that could yeah. enable them to live longer.
Yeah.
So that's certainly yeah. part of it. We have a lot more people with disabilities mm-hmm. and with recognized disabilities, too,
yeah.
than we used to. Because yeah. one of the things with autism is it seems like there are a lot more people with autism than there used to be.
Yeah. Why is that, Monica?
But yeah, I mean, we didn't actually recognize autism as a thing until the 40s. And even right. then, it took a long time for it to be a diagnosis. And we've really expanded our definition of what it is over the past couple of decades. So there may be reasons why there are more autistic people than there were in the past. But I think a large part of it is just lack of knowledge of what the disability is mm-hmm. and lack of diagnosis. And we talk about it in different ways than we once did. So now we've got a definition of autism spectrum disorder, and it's diagnosed mm-hmm. in a particular way and diagnosed a lot more mm-hmm. than it once was. But I don't think that means we didn't have autistic people before then.
Yeah. Yeah. There was that huge spike in the number of autism diagnoses in the late 90s. But if you look at the DSM revision in 1994, they vastly expanded the criteria for a diagnosis of autism, both at what we might call a higher functioning as well as lower functioning. They kind of blew it out at both ends. They expanded the criteria. And so, of course, there were more diagnoses, but folks don't quite understand that. They go, oh no, what's wrong with our kids? Why are all of them autistic now? It's right. like, well, they were before. You just didn't know that.
Yeah.
So.
And again, then people go looking for reasons like vaccines
yeah,
or
yeah.
to help explain why things and seem to have changed. But
Let's take a brief break and we'll be back with more discussion with Dr. Monica Orlando. We'd like to take a moment to thank our listeners for tuning in to Research in Progress at Shawnee State University. At Shawnee State, our mission is to prepare today's students for tomorrow's world. We value the diverse perspectives of the people within our community, on and off campus, and our role is enriching the lives of those who work, live, and discover here. We return now to our series, Research in Progress, featuring faculty research. So, Dr. Orlando, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the big questions that your research is helping us to answer, or maybe just to think about in terms of disability studies or literature or whatever other directions you want to go with that.
I guess the biggest question is, what is disability and what does it mean? And that's a really big question to answer. So I think that's why people sort of come at disability studies from a lot of different directions.
Yeah.
And try to look at where it is in the world and how that affects the way we think about it, how that affects the way we treat people with disability. Even though I'm looking at disability in literature, I try to talk to people in different areas about disability. I have a lot of family members in the medical field. So especially when I was getting started in disability studies, I talked a lot with them about disability. And that can be a hard line to cross mm-hmm. sometimes. The sort of medical view of disability is something that needs to be fixed and needs to be eradicated sometimes. And the more kind of disability studies approach, which is seeking to understand disability, I think, and not necessarily look for ways to get rid of it. So I think disability studies helps us think in a different way. I think the medical model is a really dominant one mm-hmm. and hard to get past sometimes that there are other ways of thinking about disability rather than an impairment or a deficiency of some kind or just something difficult and undesirable. So I think that's one of the big picture questions. And in looking at how disability is represented in literature, my goal is to think about how disability can be represented in more positive ways, and also how thinking about disability as an aspect of identity is helpful, and how it affects both people with disabilities who are reading or interacting with media, as well as people without disabilities trying to understand what it is. So I guess another question is, how is disability represented? What does that mean for literature, for other cultural aspects? And what does that mean for people with disabilities who are also both being depicted and are consumers mm-hmm. of the things that feature disability in some way?
Part of the discussion around disability and representations of disability have partly centered on the language that we use. I've seen some discussion on social media about whether you would use a phrase like a person with autism or an autistic person. Mm-hmm. And it seems that folks who are disabled prefer the latter, like I'm an autistic person, whereas it's more coming from like non-disabled allies, like, no, it's a person with autism, like it's a spice or something.
Got a little autism thrown in there.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if you can kind of speak to the ways that maybe non-disabled people or people who at least don't identify as disabled, how can we be good allies? How do we listen? How do we address the field of disability studies as non-disabled people?
I think the most important piece is to listen to people with disabilities.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I was so interested in life writing about and by people with disabilities, because a lot of literature about disability and just texts about disability in general are from the perspective of non-disabled people mm-hmm. trying to describe and talk about the disabled person. And so listening helps, and sometimes listening is difficult, and mm-hmm. particularly with people with autism, sometimes they're nonverbal, sometimes they can't
yeah.
write for themselves, sometimes they can't actually represent themselves in traditional ways. So that can be a challenge, I think. It's not an insurmountable challenge, and mm-hmm. not something that we should just push to the side because it's hard. But like for the language question, different people with disabilities feel very differently about
yeah.
that. There are some people who are very strong advocates of the person first language and don't want disability to be the first thing that people think of about them. And so that's why person with autism or whatever. Other people feel that it's a very big part of their identity. And so they mm-hmm. want to be called an autistic person or an autist, or, you know, there's
yeah.
like all different
yeah.
versions. And I think it's up to the individual to decide how they want to be identified. When I was writing about people with autism or autistic people in my dissertation,
yeah.
I acknowledged that, you know, that there isn't a perfect term.
Yeah.
I'm going to switch back and forth when I'm using it because there isn't one term that fits everybody or that everybody prefers.
Mm-hmm.
And as a non-autistic person, I'm just going to kind of acknowledge that I'm not using the term that everybody, you know, wants for themselves, but here are some of the options. So yeah, I think listening is one of the key ways to get to try to understand disabled experience, as well as to be respectful of people in different positions. There are so many disabilities too, that disability cannot just mean one thing.
No, it can't.
And so like people with disabilities entails a whole lot of different people with all different experiences who have different attitudes toward it. And some people who have something that could be identified as a disability don't want to be considered disabled.
Right.
When I was teaching a class on disability in literature and film, when I was in grad school, a number of students in the class had something that could be considered a disability and, you know, maybe identified as having anxiety or having dyslexia or something that when we talked about, like, what is a disability, some of them were like, I never thought about this as a disability and I don't consider myself disabled. Yeah. So, I mean, it was kind of a sticky point for some of them. Like,
yeah,
I guess this counts, but I don't want to think about myself in that way, or I don't want other people to think about me like that.
Yeah. That weird intersection between like identity and policy, like what things are covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act versus what you feel as a person. Like, do you identify in that particular way? There's sometimes a pretty significant gap there, and there isn't one solution to that issue. When I was in graduate school, we talked a lot about reflexivity in doing research and, you know, articulating the choices you were making and identifying them as choices. Like, so there's a lot of footnotes in my writing where it's like, I'm using this term, this is why these other terms exist. This is why I've picked this one, but I'm going to acknowledge that it's not the only way to talk about this. So it's tricky. It's a tricky rhetorical landscape for sure.
Yeah. And that's why it's important. It's important to keep studying it, because I don't think there are answers. We're not going to arrive at like, here's the right way to do it. Here's the right way to talk about it. Because our understanding is always changing and different people have different ways of thinking about it. So
yeah, and as research advances, there are going to be changes in terms of what sorts of disorders or disabilities we might be able to identify at an earlier age or might be able to resolve in some way. We're going to have to keep having those conversations, for sure.
Yeah, I know there was recent news about they did some gene mapping and identified specific genes that cause autism.
Yeah.
So it seems like they're moving towards some different understanding, I guess, of causes.
Yeah.
Because for a long time, it's been very difficult to determine what causes it. And again, some people don't really like the idea of identifying causes, because that might be something that we can act on and eliminate autism. And if that's something that you identify as part of, you know, an important part of who you are, that's pretty uncomfortable, you know, to say that this is something we're going to have the power to eliminate in the future.
Yeah, there's just a little sign that lights up in the back of my head that goes, eugenics. Like, we don't want to go down that road, especially something like autism is so behavior-based, and it's almost as though, like, well, when we expand the criteria for what counts as autism, are we really just narrowing what is considered normal? You know, there's people I know who I went to school with, and like, in retrospect, I think if the criteria had been what they are now, they would be autistic. But when I was a kid, they were just kind of weird or like a little different and maybe a little literal or something like that. And I think about how their life would have been so different if they had that diagnosis. And I don't know if it would have been better. Maybe it would have been better in some ways, because they would have had more support. But it also is, because those diagnoses are stigmatized, it also carries with it some potential for harm, it seems like, too. So,
and that's another one of these sort of overlaps between the medical side and the social side, or the identity side, is how we treat it, how we decide it needs to be treated.
Yeah.
And the diagnosis question of whether that's helpful or harmful and what that means for an individual.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially in terms of health insurance and employability and all that other stuff, where those things shouldn't affect your education, your employment, but they do. People discriminate even when they don't tell you they're discriminating. So it can create all these layers of different problems. And
that's really another part of disability studies, I think, is kind of the disability rights side of things and disability policy and what are things that can be done to make life better for people with disabilities, because mm-hmm. I don't remember the statistic off the top of my head, but the number of people with disabilities who are employed full-time is extremely low. Yeah. It can be very difficult for people to go into a traditional workplace without accommodations or without understanding of what they might need or mm-hmm. what is going to be different. So there's a lot that still needs to be done in terms of policy and real-world stuff. Yeah. That I think the artistic side of things, I mean, thinking about representations in literature, in film, and other sorts of texts can change the way that people yeah. think about disability in other contexts. So it's sometimes a helpful thing, I think, that there is more, at least, representation, recognition of people with disabilities, so that mm-hmm. it might affect other parts of society, maybe gradually.
Yeah. Well, and I had a student who wrote a paper about income inequality among disabled people. Even disabled people who are employed tend not to get promoted. They tend not to get raises. And so there's an income gap mm-hmm. even among people who are employed full-time if they have a disability, which is, you know, we could sure address that with some policy, but alas, we can't even seem to do it for women. Yep. Sorry about it.
If you're a woman and a disabled person, you know, you've got multiple layers.
Of, imagine, you yeah. know, it's bananas, folks. It's just bananas. So let's say we have listeners out there who are hearing this conversation, hearing about this research, and they're thinking that maybe this is something they'd like to pursue. How do you become a professor and a researcher in this field? Or maybe how did you get here anyway?
Yeah, I'm not sure how others get here. When I went to graduate school, I knew I wanted to get a PhD in English. I really did not have a sense of what I wanted to do or what research I wanted to focus on, except for I was interested in American literature. So I kind of mm-hmm. I did some of that. but then, as I said, I kind of stumbled into autobiography as an area that I was interested in. And autobiography about autism in particular, I was sort of told at the time, this isn't a neat fit for the job market mm-hmm. or for my program necessarily, but it was what I wanted to do, so I kind of just did it. And I was lucky to find an advisor who did rhetoric of health and medicine and had focused on mental illness, so she was very supportive and encouraging and, you know, kind of had some expertise that helped, I think, with what I was interested in doing. So I ended up really liking what I did, even if it was a little bit off the beaten path, I think, mm-hmm. for what other people in my program were doing. But I'm grateful I found a job where I'm able to, you know, yeah. to teach the things that I like and do some of the research that I like. And it's really since I've been working here and teaching young adult literature that I've gotten more immersed in the young adult literature side of disability and literature. So I'm not sure my path is the recommended one or the standard one, but I think it kind of worked for me to getting where I am.
I don't know if there is a standard path. I think we all, like, I didn't set out in my dissertation or in my PhD, like, oh, I'm going to be a rhetorician of health and medicine. Did not really know that's what I was going to do, but that's kind of just where my interests took me mm-hmm. ultimately. And so, you know, that's where you just kind of end up where you end up. It's mm-hmm. weird. You would think we would be much more deliberate.
I'm sure some people are. And I feel like some people came in knowing I want to do this and ended up doing that. But it seems like more of the time people change their minds once they explore other options and kind of figure out, hey, this is pretty interesting. I'm just going to go this way.
Yeah. It's more of a choose your own adventure. Like you sit back at this point in our careers where we're doing some stuff. We have jobs. We're, you know, doing research. And it's like, if I had chosen a different fork there and there and there, I would be in a much different place mm-hmm. research-wise or even, you know, professionally might be in a very different place. Yeah. So there's lots of ways to get where you're going. If our listeners would like to learn more about disability in literature for young people or about disability studies in general, where are some places they can go for that?
The Disability Studies Quarterly is a free online journal that I think is a great place for finding out about disability studies, both like kind of figuring out what it is, as well as exploring whatever you might be interested in. Mm-hmm. It's at dsq-sds.org. It's hosted by by Ohio State University, actually. And all of their present and past articles are available for free, which is pretty unusual with an academic journal.
Yeah.
So you can easily search for things, click around and find interesting disability studies stuff to read about. Again, if you just kind of want to figure out what it is, there's a lot of kind of foundational stuff, as well as interesting kind of explorations of different topics. Again, all the different kind of branches of disability studies that we talked about. I mean, kind of the literary side, the rhetoric side, as well as the policy side. There's education. I was browsing the site recently and found a really interesting article about Frozen, Elsa and Frozen as a disabled figure.
That's which I fascinating.
Kind of thought about, but they're making an argument that it's a positive representation and that I guess one of the producers has a son who had been diagnosed with diabetes, and he started thinking about his son as having been born with this impairment and how it kind of changed things for him. And he started thinking about Elsa as having been born with this difference.
Yeah.
Although it's, you know, kind of a, it's a power in some ways, but it's also something that disadvantages her and makes things difficult.
Yeah.
So I guess this producer kind of, this was in the process of when the movie was being made, and he kind of asked them to rethink how they were shaping this character to make her less of a villainess and more of, you know, someone who's kind of stuck, you know, that she's got something that makes her different and people are treating her differently because of that. And she has to kind of deal with it. I don't know. I thought that was really interesting. So there are kind of pop culture things like that, that I think are easy entry points for people who might be interested in thinking about disability and disability studies. And you can kind of look at things that you're familiar with from that perspective. So I'd recommend that. I always recommend that to my students if they're doing disability studies projects in my Intro to Lit class. And it's there's a lot of stuff that's very accessible, I think.
And a lot of the authors whose work is published there are disabled. Mm-hmm. So to kind of bring it back to your earlier point about the importance of listening to people with disability, there are a lot of disabled scholars who are writing in the field, and a lot of them publish in DSQ. It's a great place.
Yeah, and it's associated with the Society for Disability Studies, which is kind of the, it is the primary organization, I think, for the study of disability. So it's a great place to kind of start learning about the field. Another thing in terms of literature for young people, the Schneider Family Book Awards is a set of book awards given through the American Library Association each year for children's literature, middle grade literature, and teen books that offer kind of constructive representations of disability experience. So in my young adult lit class, that's one place I point people for good books about disability. It's a good place to find out about books that you might be interested in that are being published for young readers that at least the award givers have decided are good books. You know, not everybody agrees with what's a good book about disability, but but a lot of them feature prominently characters with disability in ways that are that are positive or that show that they're, you know, more than a stereotype, kind of thing. I think one of the pitfalls of looking for books that contain disability in some ways, that they can be hard to find if you don't know what you're looking for. So I think the book awards are a good list, and I think they include some of the runners up and things. So there's a good list of different books for each year that have been considered as being on the good side.
Yeah. Cool. I did not know about that list, so that's good to know. Special thanks to our guest, Dr. Monica Orlando. Thanks also to Dr. Michael Barnhart and the Center for Creative Audio at Shawnee State University in the Vern Rife Center. Our podcast is produced by Pat Spradlin and sponsored by the Shawnee State University Teaching and Learning Center. For more information about Shawnee State and the Teaching and Learning Center, visit our website at www.shawnee.edu and search for Teaching and Learning Center.